Welcome to Richer Life Insights. Our goal is to help you drive more money, motivation, and meaning into your life. Today I'm having a conversation with Alina Tugend. She's done a tremendous amount of research on mistakes. So we're going to talk about how we should be really ashamed of our mistakes. All right, no, that's not exactly what we're going to talk about. Her research is into how we make mistakes, why we make mistakes, and how, most importantly, we can learn from our mistakes. So she writes an awesome column for the New York Times. It's called Shortcuts. Some of the column titles are, and I love this, Don't Act Old, Do I Really Have to Brand Myself, and Sometimes Quitting is the Right Thing to Do. It's a very insightful column, and she takes a topic and she looks at it from a different perspective, which I love. And she's also the author of a brand new book called Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. So firstly, thank you so much for being here and sharing this message, Alina.
My pleasure.
So this idea, Better by Mistake, came to you after you made a mistake. So tell me about how this book came to be, from this mistake that led to a column, and now it's this book. How did that happen?
Well, you're right. I made a mistake in a column, and of course it wasn't my first mistake, and it won't be my last, but it was a column that I write for the Times, and it was a small error, but it upset me. And I had to correct it, and I run a public correction, which, you know, is not pleasant. And it started me thinking, after this happened, while I was still beating myself up over it and flagellating myself, why are we taught when we're children, when we're in kindergarten and first and second grade, that we all learn from our mistakes, and we're told quotes from Einstein and Edison about mistakes are the road to better learning and to greater experience and all these things. But in reality, most of us hate and dread them. We don't embrace them. So I looked at that, and I wrote a column and looked at some of the research and discovered some really fascinating research. And my readers agreed because they started emailing me saying how grateful they were to see a column like this about mistakes and why we dread them. And through various processes, an editor was interested, a publishing house was interested, and it became a book.
That's interesting. So you made this mistake, and you had to do this sort of apology. And in the book, you talk about what that mistake was. And, you know, it was pretty minor. Pretty minor.
Right.
As far as mistakes go, that was more on the minor side.
Exactly.
And so if I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, all right, you know, I know I'm supposed to learn from my mistakes. Like you said, that's what we're taught. But, you know, mistakes don't feel right. I mean, there's usually a negative consequence that comes from our mistakes. And so are you suggesting we should embrace mistakes? Should we make more mistakes so we should learn, that we can learn from? Or what does the research say there?
Well, that's a good question, because I think it's confusing. People think, well, why do I want to make more mistakes, and what possible good comes out of that? And we all know people we've worked with or worked for us that constantly make same mistake over and over again. I'm not advocating that. It's not so much let's go run out and make mistakes. And I don't feel good, even after writing this book, I don't feel good about mistakes. I don't go, yahoo, I just made another mistake. What I'm saying is the culture, our culture, and way we learn is that mistakes are bad, yet we all make them. We cannot be perfect. That's not part of human nature. And while that's a platitude, we always hear that to err is human. None of us, or very few of us, let us say, really internalize that mistakes are a part of learning. And if we fear mistakes, if we work in a way or parent or teach in a way that says mistakes are bad and avoid them at all costs, we lose creativity. We're afraid to take risks. We're afraid to make great effort, because the greater effort, the more out of our regular day-to-day living, the more we move out of our comfort zone, and the more we try new things, the more likely we are to make mistakes. That's the nature of things. If we keep doing the same thing over and over again, we're less likely, because we're used to it, we know what we're doing. But this leads to, as I said, it leads to lack of creativity, it leads to lack of innovation, and it leads us to, when we do make mistakes, rather than owning up to it and saying, okay, what did I learn from this? How can we prevent it? Where do we look deeper? It leads us to just try to blame others, or maybe we beat ourselves up. That's not helpful either. Or we finger point, or we cover it up. And none of that is helpful. And if you'd like, I'll go on to the research of what's been shown with Professor Carol Dweck and how children, when they're praised for being smart.
I love Dweck's research. And just one thing first. It sounds like maybe there are two benefits, really, to this. I guess the first is not having the fear of making a mistake. Because like you said, as soon as you start worrying, gosh, you know, I probably shouldn't maybe write that blog or write that book or take that chance, all of a sudden you sort of limit your ability. So by saying, listen, you know what, I'm going to make mistakes, I know I am, I don't really care, that sort of opens you up to do a lot more. So it sounds like maybe that's the first benefit. And the second is, if you do make a mistake, it's not sort of being shamed for it and saying, all right, that never happened. It's really embracing it, looking at it and saying, yep, I screwed up, but you know what, I'm going to try to learn from it. Is that true? It's like almost two benefits there?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you expressed that well, and I think that's the important aspect of it. And while it sounds rather simple and obvious, I think many of your listeners, readers, will say, well, yeah, I know that. It's incredibly hard to internalize. And even after I've written this book and done so much research, it's still hard for me at times. I think, I can talk later about this, I think I've changed. I think I've learned a lot. But it's still hard for me to acknowledge that I make mistakes, depending on what the mistakes are, and also to look at it and just look at it as a mistake and not as some sort of deep flaw in myself.
Right, right. And so having written this, having done the research, do you find that you are less fearful of making mistakes? Are you taking more chances?
I think I'm taking more chances, but I think what I'm also doing is being more accepting of my imperfection and being more, and of my children and of my husband. Well, he might not agree, but yes.
We can get him on later.
That's right. And I think not only am I taking more chances, but what's happening is when I do make a mistake, I won't say my first thing might feel like, oh, God. I still can have that clutch in the stomach, but I much more quickly go, okay, how'd this happen? What did I learn? And it's okay. It's okay. And if it was something that I did because I was careless or lazy or didn't bother looking something up, I'll double check that. But I'm a pretty conscientious person. And I also am more accepting that we all just screw up sometimes. And I don't sit there and keep going, how could that happen? How could I happen? How could I do it? So I think, yes, and I am more willing to say it's all about the process and the effort that I'd say largely. Of course, we all want good results. But it can't just be about the results. It's got to be about the process. And I think, more importantly, I'm teaching my children, and they're beginning to learn it. It's not just about getting the home run. They love baseball. But it's about learning how to bat and really working on your batting. So if you go up every time and you're not hitting well, that's okay. What are you learning? I'm not saying they still don't want to make the home runs. But I think understanding the process, not just the results, has been a key thing that I've learned.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you talked earlier about Carol Dweck's research on the fixed mindset versus the growth mindset.
That's correct.
I've done a lot of research into this area too, and I find it very, very fascinating because it really, it's a lens, and it really colors your approach to the world. And so maybe for the listeners that aren't familiar with her research, you can discuss what it means to have a fixed versus a growth mindset.
Yeah, like you said, I agree. I think it's key. Professor Carol Dweck is a professor at Stanford University, and she really has done groundbreaking research on children and mistakes. And what she discovered is that over many years of looking at this thing is there are, generally speaking, two kinds of mindset. It's never as clear-cut as it sounds, but generally speaking, there are those who view the world that they have innate talents and they're good at things and bad at things, and that's the way it is. They're good at math, they're bad at writing, they're good at baseball, they're bad at music, and, you know, they can't really change that. And if you have that kind of mindset, mistakes aren't going to do a lot except just tell you, you failed. Because if you can't learn from mistakes, if you're either good or bad at something, what good are mistakes? Now, with a growth mindset, it's the ability to see, it's to see, those people see ability and intelligence as something that's malleable. And therefore, with enough efforts, we can overcome obstacles. Therefore, mistakes are really part of the learning process. We don't just say that, but we believe that. we see how each time we make a mistake, we can go back and learn from it and understand. And, you know, this is part of what, I'm jumping maybe a little ahead, but part of what really can make great, people are really great at their subject, whether it be chess or sports or music, they really focus on their mistakes and learn from them and focus on in detail and how can they improve and how can they improve. And this is something we may not all be, you know, world class in our field, but we can take away on just an everyday basis. But if we don't have a growth mindset, again, mistakes do nothing. Now, I'd like to tell about Professor Dweck's research with the 400 fifth graders. Is that okay?
Absolutely, yeah. That's in the book, and I thought that was very interesting as well.
I watched this. I went out to Palo Alto and watched some of this research, and it was pretty fascinating. She and her researchers took 400 fifth graders. They were given two tasks to choose from. One that they would learn little from but do well, or another more challenging one that might be more interesting but induce more mistakes. Now, before they were that, let me back up. I apologize. I think I skipped ahead. She took 400 fifth graders. Half were randomly praised for being really smart, for doing well on a test. The others were praised for their effort. So they did well on a test. Half were said, you were really smart. That was great. You must be just so smart. The other half were said, you put out a really good effort. Good for you. Then those 400 fifth graders were given two tasks to choose from. One an easy one they would learn little from but do well, and the other more challenging one that might be interesting but would probably they do more mistakes. So that's what's fascinating is the majority who were praised for being smart chose the simple task so they could prove they were smart. Well, 90% of those who were told they had tried hard selected the more difficult one. And I found this fascinating. Then the students were given another test above their grade level, on which many performed poorly. And then they were asked to write anonymously about their experience to another school and report their scores. 37% of those who were told they were smart lied about their scores, while only 13% of the other group did. And I think, and she's done this kind of research with different socioeconomic classes at different grades. She's done it with college. She's done it below. And over it shows when people are taught that it's about effort and changing, and you can grow and change, they're much more willing to try difficult things.
Absolutely. The whole fixed versus growth mindset, I've always thought of it as like a fixed mindset is sort of the radio is on or off. You've either got the skills or you don't. You're born that way or you're not. And the growth mindset is like the volume button. It's like you might be low in a skill now, but you have the ability to turn it up. And I do think, depending on where you fall on the growth versus fixed continuum, and like you said, it's never one or the other, but if you have that growth mindset, you're going to be willing to take a little bit more more risks and more chances.
And also, if you think, I'm sorry, Robert. Yeah.
And go ahead.
If you think about it that way, it's these are things you can change. I mean, she's done research where college students read essays about growth, about mindsets being malleable, about, you know, this exact thing. And the ones who read about your intelligence and your skills can change and develop, really react differently in the future. And she's done that in junior high schools and ongoing classes where some children were taught this about growth mindsets and others weren't. And the children, the teachers who had no idea who was in which group found that, in fact, the kids who were taught about increased growth mindset showed they were more motivated, and the teachers didn't even know which ones were taught and which ones weren't, and yet they picked out those students as being more motivated, more willing to learn. So I think her research is crucial, and I think this leads just to one other point, which is that Americans have this weird love affair with the idea that things are effortless, that we really shouldn't put a lot of effort. We like to, even though we may know that Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant practices a hell of a lot, or Yo-Yo Ma, we kind of see it as just this natural grace and ability. We really don't embrace the idea that things are hard and we have to work hard at them, even though, again, we give lip service to that. We really like much more the idea that we effortlessly accomplish things. And I think this is something we have to move away from.
No, of course we do. I mean, you're right. We look at these world-class, whether they're athletes, musicians, people at the top of their field, whatever that field may be. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe we look at that and we think, yeah, you know, they put in the time, but they were just maybe born that way. Do you think we make that sort of interpretation because we, I don't know, maybe don't want to put forth the effort, or we think, well, if they're born that way, then of course they're successful.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely, I think both reasons. I think, I don't think it's conscious necessarily, but I think people, it excuses us from making the effort. Look, I do believe people are born, this is an ongoing debate, but born with natural talents and abilities. Even if that natural ability may be being more open to learning, so therefore we're better at learning and grasping concepts. But I believe, you know, I say in the book, I'm a terrible singer, you know, and I know I was born that way. However, after reading all this and seeing some of the research, I believe I could be a much better singer than I am if I worked at it, if that was important enough to me to work at. I used to think really that wasn't possible. Now, I don't think I'm going to be a Grammy winner, but that's not Dweck's research, and I think this is where people start dismissing not just your research, but these whole concepts. It's, oh, no, I mean, you're trying to tell me everyone's the same, everyone's talented, everyone can. That's not what it is. It's that everyone has far more potential than they think they do.
And that's really, I mean, that's really what this is all about. It's finding the potential, it's maximizing our potential, and it's really how can we achieve our best? And
that's right.
Maybe you'll never win American Idol.
I really doubt that.
I'd vote for you. But you could definitely get better. And I think it really comes down to, do you even want to get better as a singer? Maybe you
that's
don't.
Right.
Maybe
that's
you
right. And that, to me, that's not really, I enjoy singing, but you know, I don't do it publicly. But I think that that's the point. It's not where I'm going to put a lot of my effort. But especially when people are younger and kids, it's too easy for them to put themselves in boxes. And that's the time they should be exploring and trying to figure out what they like. And if they shut themselves down by saying, I'm just not good at that, that's a real shame. It doesn't mean they have to try everything and anything, but it does mean that they, you know, and then as we grow, it does mean that they should be aware they have the potential. And I think, you know, that's exactly what you said. As we get into the workplace, it's too easy to put ourselves in boxes and say, well, I just know I'm not good at that, so I'm not going to even try it. And especially in this modern age, we all know how flexible we need to be. And if we, you know, in terms of all this stuff about jobs becoming less secure, about having to branch out on our own, and this is scary for a lot of people, but it's going to be a lot scarier if we think, well, I'm just not good at that. We need to learn. We can grow and learn how to do it if we want to.
And that is so true. And I think you really see that, like you mentioned, really play out with kids when they're young. They try anything, they make mistakes,
yeah.
They fall down, they don't really care. But
right.
Then as they get a little older, all of a sudden they start getting a little worried. You know, I don't really want to do that because, you know, people are watching, and if I make a mistake, I'm going to look like
That's
an
it.
Idiot. And don't you think that sort of process takes place when we're starting in our career? Like when we're, if I get a new job somewhere and I'm starting a career, it's like, all right, I can make mistakes because I'm new here. But
right.
What happens when you become an expert at something? All of a sudden, don't you think you are just, for many, deathly afraid to make a mistake?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that that's a real shame because, you know, as the experts I talked about how experts, you know, using the word expert, the academics, the researchers I talked about, that's a real problem when we start feeling like we have this certain area of competence and we better protect it and we can't move out of it. I think that's, you know, that's a real problem. I mean, and one of my favorite examples, and in the book, as you know, I write about culture, and that was one of the things that, as you know, I talk about, compare primarily Asian and American and Canadian cultures in terms of our approach to mistake. In the North American way, it's a whole cultural concept, which is very different than Asians. And one of my favorite anecdotes in Asian culture is that in Japan is that there was a survey on the favorite word the favorite words. There's been some national surveys, and effort and persistence were two of the most favorite words in Japanese culture. And this whole idea that outweighs results. You know, I think that in America it would be effortless. And I think it's why I like doing the culture chapter so much is it really showed us a different way we can look at this. We don't have to look at it the same old way.
And I loved that research too. I mean, it's really eye-opening, the
yeah.
difference between sort of the North American approach and the Asian approach. And so if you know, globally, sort of generically speaking, the Asian culture is really more about effort and persistence and progress, and the American culture is really more about results and sort of that fixed mindset, how do you think that's going to play out with the economy sort of going forward?
I got to say, that's a tough question because, you know, then as I say, no culture has a monopoly on being right. And I think there are aspects, as people say, there are aspects of our culture that people love, this, such as, you know, you sort of can get second and third chances, and that's not so true in other cultures. So I think I'd have to defer that to I think I'd be afraid to make any predictions based on that. But I think what we do see is that, especially in early education in Japan, and that's a lot, what I talk about a lot, we could learn so much about how they're willing to learn from mistakes and how they're willing. What I found so fascinating is that preschools and early education, children can make a mistake, and the teacher will call them to the board, and they'll make the mistake. And here in America, the teacher would be much more likely to go, oh, don't worry, don't try not to embarrass the child, try not to make it anything humiliating, quickly correct the child. In Japan, that's not the case. In Japan, the mistake will be played out on the board. Sometimes they can go on for 10 or 12 minutes because the idea is not, is this a correct answer? They'll ask the other students, who made the same, you know, mistake as Yoshi? 10, 15 kids might raise their hand. The teacher will then go over, let's say it's math and you're multiplying denominators when you shouldn't be in fractions. They won't just say, no, that's wrong. They'll keep looking at the mistake because for them, the mistake is not just a mistake. It's a way that's partially correct. And they want to see the children to understand the process, not just the end answer. And I think that's what we are kind of missing in our culture is we tend to rush to see what's right and what's wrong, not how did I get to this point?
Yeah, it seems to be very, again, the fixed, it's very black and white. You're correct or you're wrong, and if you're wrong, here's how you fix it.
That's
rather
right.
Than, you know, sort of that process-oriented approach where, all right, let's try to figure this out.
And if I could say one more thing, I think with the fixed and growth, I think some people may be listening to this or reading this and saying, oh, I think I have a growth mindset, and that may well be true, but I think we also tend to be more open when it's things we don't care as much about.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. That is so true because, yeah. I mean, you're a writer. I mean, you write for the New York Times, and so the mistake that you made, I mean, I'm a writer, but if I would have made that, it would have been, you know, whatever, big deal. But for you, you're an expert. You are a writer. And that was a much more personal mistake than if someone else would have made it.
Right. And if I make a mistake, I think I'm an okay cook. But if I don't do a great job in cooking something, I don't want to screw up a formal dinner party, but I'm okay with it. I'm not going to be – but – and I'm willing to learn about cooking because I don't think I'm really good at it. And, you know, again, it's something I want to invest. But if it's a chef and he or she screws up, they're going to feel terrible. And also if it's something that we think men should be good at, I think men might be more embarrassed. I'm generalizing, I know I am, but men might be more embarrassed about not being able to fix something manually or do finances. Well, women might, but they might not care that they don't know how to dance or that they, you know, messed up in some childcare thing, forgot to pack the diapers. You know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying. Actually, I embrace the fact that I am horrible at fixing things. But with an area that I think I excel at, if I make a mistake, that's really going to be challenging for me. So how, for the people reading, for the people listening, who want to be an expert, who are an expert, who want to improve some area of their life, what's the takeaway for them for being open to challenges, being open to taking risks, and to be open to making mistakes? How do you get them to that point where it's like, all right, I'm just going to put it out there, and we're going to see what happens?
Okay, I'll give you some things, and then we can tell me if this fits. I think we have to realize perfection is a myth, and we have to really, really realize that, not just, yeah, of course, nobody's perfect. Because I think we're surrounded by overt and covert slogans all the time and messages that's like failure is not an option. Only losers make mistakes. So I think we tie ourselves up in knots, making mistakes or feeling ashamed. So we just need to put aside that idea of perfectionism. And that doesn't mean we don't strive to be the best we can. I think people can misinterpret this to say, oh, she's just saying, you know, just any old thing works. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, but we strive to be the best we can, but if we expect perfection, we'll inevitably fall short. And that will also inevitably overshadow our willingness to experiment, to take risks, and to challenge ourselves. And we have to be really careful of receiving and giving contradictory messages, that it's all right to make mistakes, but not where it counts. You know, I think that we tend to sit there and say, oh, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to when I was writing this book that say, oh, yeah, no, I'm fine with mistakes. I'm good with mistakes. And I know them, and I know they're not. That's the message they tell themselves.
Right.
When they say about their kids. Oh, no, I tell my kids it's okay to make mistakes. And I've done this, you know, and then you yell at them for even just spilling the milk because you're tired and upset. And we're all going to do that. I'm not saying we're not going to be perfect. But we have to be careful, especially when it gets to children. And I have a son who's 15 and he's moving up to the college years. It's a really hard balance to sit there and praise the effort and not go, oh, my God, if you don't do well on this test, you may not get into college.
Your fixed mindset jumps out.
Exactly.
Right.
And the fear and all this. And it's just being really, really aware of it. And I think that, you know, I tell this anecdote that I love of a friend of mine who drives her son home from kindergarten and asks what he learned. And he said, nothing. And she said, you didn't learn anything? And he said, no, my teacher said you learn by making mistakes, and I didn't make any today. And, you know, it's such a cute – she told me this even before I ever wrote this book, even before I thought of writing the column. And I thought it was such a cute anecdote, and it just shows how we change, how sadly we change as we grow older. And I think that – we also need to realize if we've made the mistake, a lot of other people probably have, we aren't flawless, and that we need to, you know, we need to learn how to give and receive criticism and negative feedback. And that's a very hard thing to do, but it is something that's learnable. We somehow think these sort of, they're called, you know, non-cognitive skills. It's not a very good word, but we're not learning how to write, but we're learning how to give and receive criticism. We're learning how to talk to people, how to apologize. These are things we can learn. There's actual skill sets for those.
There definitely are. I mean, I don't know. I guess people think, well, it should be natural. It should be innate that we know how to do this. And it's completely not. It's absolutely unnatural.
It is unnatural, and we all have baggage from our childhood, from our parents. Our parents have baggage from their parents. If we grew up in a family where nobody ever apologized, that's what we've learned. If nobody ever admitted they were wrong, that's what we've learned. And yet, we all become people in the workplace, and we all become, you know, most of us become partners and spouses. And it now is, you know, I think a lot of this is cultural, and I don't think change ends at home, but I do think it begins at home, you know.
And so, can I play devil's advocate for a moment?
Sure.
Okay. So, I am a big proponent of sort of focusing on one's strengths, focusing on the things that you do really well, and maybe not spending so much time on my weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, if we are, I'm putting a word in your mouth, but if we're focused on mistakes, isn't that sort of focusing on our weaknesses? Shouldn't we sort of disregard our mistakes and say, whatever, they're mistakes. Let's focus on my successes. Let's learn from my successes and forget about my mistakes.
I think that's a really good question. And as you are talking, I'm trying to find a certain research. Let me, first of all, what I'm saying is, I think that's a good point, and I think it's a good thing to clarify. We don't need to focus. I mean, when I talked, you know, and maybe we should differentiate when I talked about world-class people focusing on their mistakes. That's when they're deliberately trying to improve themselves. We need to acknowledge our strengths so let's put aside what I said about those world-class people for a sec. We can go back to it. But as regular people, we need to be very aware of our strengths and our abilities and to be very aware that we can get better. I don't think that's a negative message. We're not saying we're bad at this, and so we're going to make mistakes. We're saying we're good, and we all have this great potential to learn. And I'm a good writer, and as I always tell my kids, everyone can use an editor. My kids see an editor as someone who's just pointing out something they did wrong. I see a good editor, and I emphasize the word good, as someone who can constantly make your writing better. So I think I'm a good writer. I've gotten praise for my writing. I've gotten, I'm in the New York Times, which is great. That doesn't mean when my editor says, you know, this paragraph really doesn't work, I sit there and go, oh, my God, now I'm a bad writer. Mm-hmm. No, I think, oh, because we have a relationship, and this is part of it. You're developing relationships with people who you feel comfortable having. You can't accept negative feedback or constructive criticism from people who you don't feel safe with. And that's another thing we can talk about. But I don't look at it as her telling me I'm a bad writer. I look at her as helping make my writing better. And I think we need, if we start from a place where we feel bad about ourselves, that's not a good place to start. We have to start from a place, and this, how do we do that? That's a whole other question. But I think if we're raised in a family that makes us feel good, and teachers and schooling, that makes us realize we're competent at a lot of things, and we're able to master things. And then mistakes are not about making us feel bad, but making us better. And just, I want to back up a sec, because I think it's so important when we talk about self-esteem. Too often people think self-esteem, and this was the fashion in the 60s, 70s, and 80s to some extent. Oh, self-esteem. We tell kids they're great. We tell them they're stars. We give them trophies, and they'll have self-esteem. And, this has been mocked a lot. I think it came out of a good place, but it's wrong. We don't, and a lot of the psychologists who promoted this are changing. We don't give people self-esteem by giving them stars and awards and pats on the heads. First of all, kids become cynical very quickly. But we give them self-esteem by helping them master things and helping them learn resilience.
One of my favorite passages in your book was pretty much what you just said. You cannot give someone self-esteem. They have to earn the self-esteem.
Exactly.
And that is such a valuable insight, because if you have children, I think we kind of feel like we have to constantly praise our children and sort of give them the self-esteem. And like you said, that can actually come back to hurt you.
And that can come back to hurt you and come back to hurt them. And I think it's very hard. We don't like seeing our kids unhappy or uncomfortable. But they have to be at times. And I have to tell myself this over and over. They have to be at times, because that's the only way we learn. They some have to learn, the cliche, to fall down and pick themselves up, but they also have to learn they're not going to be the best on every team. And if they work harder, guess what? They may be the best. They may not. Effort doesn't always mean you're going to be the best. We can't have everyone be number one. We know that. But effort means you're going to be better. And it's a message I've had to – my son's played baseball, and when my son was in a batting slump, he was bemoaning and trying to blame everybody he could, the umpires, the coaches, when he was younger. And I said, if you really want to improve, you go out there and practice batting. Otherwise, you can't blame anyone but yourself. I may have said it a little nicer. I may not. But I'm just saying that the reality is we're not doing them any favors if we try to blame other people, or if we just say, well, you know what, maybe you're really not very good at batting. Or if we lie to them and say, no, you're really good. You're just as good as anybody.
So the takeaway is what? You can get better?
You can get better. You can work at this if you want. If you want, I think – You worked hard, if he has or she, you've worked hard, and I think you need to work harder. And I think that if you really want to improve on this, it's your choice. You can make I've had these conversations with my son. You can make the choice to not go out and hit the ball over and over. And that's fine, but then don't complain about being low in the batting order. Or you can choose to go out there and really practice, and you'll improve. We can't give you any guarantees, but we know you'll improve. And if you want, maybe we can give you a lesson, or, we can do this. We can talk about options and helping you improve. But if you choose that you'd rather sit around and watch TV, watch SportsCenter, that's your choice, but be aware it's your choice.
So you may never be the best, but you can always be better.
You can always be better. And you can know there is, and I think we all know this, there's this real satisfaction that comes with working harder. And pushing yourself through, I believe that's true with almost everybody, and pushing yourself through a difficult spot and coming out the other end.
And so is there a process to figuring out and actually becoming better from our mistakes?
I think that, some of it depends on the mistake and what it is, but I think that I'll give you a few ideas. One is, let's say we make a mistake at work, and what do we have to be aware of when we make that mistake? Let's say we look at the mistake, we're upset about it. We have to be aware of certain things. One is, are we looking at it with hindsight bias? Are we look, whether it's our mistake and someone else's, let's say, are we looking at that mistake and jumping to a conclusion about how it happened? Hindsight bias is when we look at things from the same, you know, imagine a tunnel. We're outside the tunnel, we're peering in, and we're saying, oh, yeah, this guy should have turned left here and right here, and no wonder he screwed up and got lost. But when you're making the mistake, whatever the problem is, you're not outside the tunnel, you're inside the tunnel. So we need to take account when any mistake happens, what are the stresses, the lack of information, and the other obstacles that led us or someone else to make that mistake? We really need to be aware of hindsight bias.
And so I just want to make sure I understand that piece, because I think it's critical for this. So you're saying when you make a mistake, you look back and you try to sort of figure out in the moment what information you had at the time?
Exactly. I think what information and what stresses. If someone's working under enormous stress, enormous time constraints, et cetera, we need to look at why that's happened and what and lack of information. We need to know that. If we come back in, you know, as we all talk about Monday morning quarterbacking, if we come back and say, well, God, why didn't he just do X, Y, and Z without taking account all those other stresses, we're not doing anyone any favors. And the thing is, you know, too often people mistake reasons with excuses. Let's say I make an error in a story, and they've given me way too much work. I write a column. That's not the case. But let's say I'm a reporter on deadline, and I've been given three stories, and I'm just plowing through them, and one comes out and it has an error, and my editor comes back and says, how did this happen? And I just go, I'm sorry, you're right. And he goes, well, it shouldn't happen again. But let's say I say to him, okay, I'm not trying to give rationalizations, but I have to tell you, I was given too many stories, or however you say it more diplomatically, I'm giving you shorthand. It seems to me I'm being given a lot of stories. I'm not having the time to adequately fact check and double check, and I'm afraid this will happen again. And, you know, I was given the last story at 5 o'clock and it was due at 6. That gives the editor, if he's the kind, he or she's the kind of boss who's open and willing to listen, information that's necessary. We have to spread out this work. We can't do so much at one time. We have to give longer time for deadlines. That editor is coming with hindsight bias. All that editor is seeing is there was a mistake in the paper. But once he or she understands the stresses and how the system operated, we can fix future mistakes.
You can. And, of course, the person, let's say you made that mistake and you had these three columns. Had you not looked back and really analyzed it from a place of trying to learn rather than just, oh, man, I just screwed up.
Exactly.
You kind of were a detective, and you kind of figured out exactly maybe what contributed to the mistake. And so you're looking at these external factors, stressors, and whatnot to see if they could have been an influence. Let's just say there weren't any. Let's say you had one column and you screwed it up.
Hey, I've done it.
Okay.
I've done it.
Trust me,
we all have.
And
you look back and I try, you know, my first instinct is, oh, shit. Sorry.
That's all right. There's no FCC regulation here. You can say anything you want.
Yeah, my first instinct is really, and it still is, I admit it, to go, because I've had one since the book is out. It happened to be a quote somebody gave me with a fact that was wrong. It didn't occur to me or the editor to check the fact because it was an expert who gave me the information and it just seemed so obvious. Okay, so the first thing is, oh, God, oh, no. Am I going to have to publicly correct this? Am I wrong? I do all the research to find out fact because a reader, my dear readers, will tell me. And I sit there and I quickly – and let me tell you, this is an example of taking risks. Let me just backtrack. I chose to have an email at the bottom of my column, shortcuts@nytimes.com. I asked for that because I wanted to get reader information. I could have chosen not to do that. I mean, I don't know if eventually they would have asked me to, but that's a risk. If I chose not to do that, I wouldn't hear from a lot of negative comments I get. I get a lot of positive ones, but it was a risk I was willing to take, even though it doesn't always make me feel great, and I get readers pointing out mistakes I may never have heard from otherwise. So that's an example of a risk I was willing to take because I wasn't so afraid of mistakes.
Right, right.
Okay? So anyhow, you know, I look, I see how it occurred. I explain it to my editor. I take responsibility. Yes, this occurred. I'm sorry. This is how it happened. And this is how we have to, you know, the Times is a very formal procedure for how it publishes mistakes. And this is what we're going to have to do. And again, this goes back to being a good editor. She doesn't say, oh, my God, how could you have done that? This is bad. You better watch yourself. Because she knows I'm very conscientious. And she knows that it doesn't happen that often. Now, if I consistently made mistakes in my columns, there'd be a real problem. And we'd have to look at why that was happening, and maybe eventually I'd have to be fired. You can't do that.
Well, now, that's an interesting point. If you consistently made the same mistake, that could be a problem. But what if, like we talked about earlier, as an expert, it's important to take chances, to take risks. What if you made new mistakes every time? You didn't make the same mistakes.
Yeah, but if I made factual errors every time, and those aren't new, it's not like I'm going to repeat the same wrong fact every time. But at a certain point, I'm not saying errors are going to slip through. It's amazing. You can go through me and three editors, and it will slip through. And that happens, and that's where We're Not Perfect comes in, and that's where I have gotten better at realizing that. But at a certain point, I know how to write a column, and I know how to fact-check myself. And there's something wrong if there's an error in every column or every other column. There's just something wrong. I know that as a journalist. So even if it's not the same error, I shouldn't be doing that. Just like there's probably something wrong if accountant keeps making, maybe it's not the same accounting error, but different accounting errors, different math errors. There's probably something wrong with that account. You know, with either that accountant's under an enormous amount of stress and needs to take a break, or there's something going on. You know, there's something or it's not his field. There's something, but that's just that. I think at a certain point, that's not acceptable. And that point is different for everybody. What's wrong is to say you made one or two or three mistakes, you're out of here.
Right.
Because that doesn't take into account. Every mistake can be made for different reasons. You have to look at, as we said, why it's made, under what circumstances, and all that. And that's, you know, that's even why in corrections in the Times they say, if it's an editing error, they point that out. An editing error made this mistake. That differentiate it from the writer making the mistake. So I think that none of this is simple. It's not hard to comprehend. Once you start looking at it closer, you see all these other factors. But I still think the basic message that we need to be more accepting of our imperfection while at the same time striving to be our best is the bottom line.
And that's a great takeaway. So we're nearing the end here, but there's just a couple more things. And that is, you make a mistake. In the book, you talk about sort of three elements on how you can address basically apologizing for a mistake. Can you talk about those three elements?
Sure. Can you give me 1 second? I didn't write those down. I want to make sure I get them accurately. I don't make a mistake.
it's okay. You can make a mistake.
Okay, thank you. I like the New Yorker cartoon that shows a wife saying to her husband, "I don't want your apology. I want you to be sorry." And I say that pretty much sums up a large part of the apology problem. Saying you're sorry doesn't really mean you are. And experts have broken down a proper apology into three elements: an acknowledgement of the fault or offense, regret for it, and responsibility for it, and if possible, a way to fix the problem. And because we don't often separate out those three aspects, we often get caught up in who's to blame and find it difficult to apologize when we shouldn't be. And, you know, expert saying, there are wrong ways to apology. I want to apologize isn't an apology. That's no more than I want to lose weight is a loss of weight. Do the work. Deliver the clear, direct apology. Don't hide behind vagueness or cliches. I hate the apology, "I'm sorry if you were offended," or "I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings," which implies somehow I'm so oversensitive. You know, I don't think anybody likes that kind of apology.
No, that's sort of a backhanded apology.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that as Holly Weeks, when a personal coach or something has talked about, we need to be thinking of communicating rather than expressing regret. We're actually having a dialogue, not a monologue, when we apologize. We don't want to just dump it on people, and we don't want to make people feel bad for us. "I'm so sorry. I'm really so sorry. I feel so terrible." Then you're just asking the person you've hurt to take care of you.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I've never really thought of that.
Yeah, and you also don't want to over-apologize. I think a clear apology said once, maybe twice, and I have to say I think women particularly tend to over-apologize, and that's it. You know, to keep apologizing is not helpful for anybody. And even though the cliche is better late than never, sometimes research has found sometimes it's better early than never. It's better late than early, because if you run in and apologize, when you really hurt someone, not some minor slip up, but when you really, you need to give that person time to get it, time to think about it, time to absorb it. You can't, time to process it. You can't just sort of, again, demand they forgive you. You need to maybe think about it and realize this isn't about you. This is about them. And I think too often in apologies, we don't get that.
No, you're right. Right. I mean, when you're apologizing, it really, the emphasis is on you. Like, oh, I'm sorry. It's, you know, it's
exactly.
My fault. And make me feel better.
And we need to take accountability in this, I think, where many people feel publicly this has fallen way short. When we see public figures apologize, it's often, you know,
through their publicists.
Yeah, exactly. It's a well-spun public relations effort. It's not, and it's too, say, even saying, well, I guess the buck stops here, doesn't mean anything. You're basically saying you're accountable without really being accountable. You got to look at what are you going to change and how that's going to change. If it's an error if it's something you can't change, that has to be acknowledged too. If it's just you hurt somebody and you need to just apologize for that, that's fine. But it, again, apologies are something that can certainly be learned and taught. They are not something we automatically know.
It's a skill. You're definitely right.
Yeah.
And so just switching gears here quickly, I love doing these kinds of things, talking to experts, talking to people who have achieved success, because I'm just fascinated about how people use their time. And so I would love to know, and you have children, you have a new column for the New York Times, you've got this book, very, very busy. How do you get it all done? Like, what's your day look like, Alina?
Yeah, I get up with my kids. It's getting earlier, the older they get, as they get to school. So it's usually around 7:15. Nobody in our family is a good morning person. We're terrible morning people. So I have to tell you, I'm not one of these people who gets up at 5 a.m. and writes. I'm not one of these people who gets up 5 a.m. and goes to the gym. I stagger out of bed around 7:15. I get breakfast for the kids, get a toasted bagel, get them out the door. They walk to school. We're lucky to live where we walk. I'll check my emails. I read the paper usually the first thing. I'm still old-fashioned enough where we get the Times, and I read it pretty thoroughly. And one thing I know I am, I mean, I don't feel over – I don't. I sometimes feel overwhelmed, but I often don't. First of all, I know I'm very well organized. I think that's something that just I learned, and some of it comes naturally, some of it I learned. So I'm able to meet my deadlines without panicking for the most part. I won't say that's always true. I have a certain set routine where I know the week before my column's due, I have to think about a topic, and usually that's when I think about a topic. I don't have a list of topics. It's usually something I come up with. The column runs every 2 weeks, so I'll start thinking about it. I'll start researching it. On Monday and Tuesday, I write it, and it's due on Wednesday of that week.
Okay, so that's not pressure, writing it on Monday and Tuesday?
Not for me, no. I'm a very fast writer. I started my journalism career at United Press International, wire service, and there it was just deadline, 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 and I guess since I stuck with it, it suited me. And I think I'm just suited to that. Now, I'll tell you, if I procrastinate, and I'm not a procrastinator, but if I do, I just start panicking. So I know, I've learned over the years, if I push things off, it's just going to be worse. I don't work well under that kind of stress.
And how long did it take you to write the book? Like the first draft?
Yeah, well, you know, I got the contract in June of 2008, and my son's bar mitzvah was in November, so I'd say that was a wash between June and November. I pretty much didn't do much of anything except read some books. Then I started doing all the research, and I'd say, you know, I have a plaque on my desk that says the ultimate inspiration is the deadline, and I totally believe that. The closer you get to deadline, the harder you work. And so I'd say it's very hard for me to judge because I don't sit down for full 8-hour days and work. I work several hours at a time. I get up, I do other things. I still play tennis once or twice a week, and then when my kids come home, which after three sometime, I deal with them. So I'd say it took me 8 or 9 months maybe to write, well, not to write the draft, but to write and get the draft and get it back. And I tend to turn in pretty clean copy.
Well,
so
that's pretty quick. I mean, eight or nine months.
Right. I mean, the research was longer, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. So, That's impressive.
But it was also a really learning experience, and that was what a great thing about it was. There were times I definitely felt panicked. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if this is worth anything. I was used to writing very, you know, relatively short pieces. The longest piece I've probably ever written was 4,000 or 5,000 words for a magazine. This was almost 70,000 words.
Yeah, it's a completely different experience. And so I know this book isn't even out yet, but are you thinking about another book?
I know. I always wondered when people talked about that, why people would go, oh my gosh, I can't even think yet. Now I realize how much effort you have to put in to getting the first book out.
It's so another child.
I don't know. I just don't know. I honestly don't. I mean, it was a good experience. I really enjoyed it, but I do have to say, let's see how it goes.
Right. Oh, I understand that. And so, all right, sort of the last parting thoughts here. If someone who's listening or reading forgot everything we talked about, everything, except one thing, what would be that takeaway that they could go home and say, all right, this is that kernel, I've got it, and I'm going to turn it into something. What's the takeaway for them?
You have a lot more potential than you think you have. And the only way to succeed, the only way to expand on that potential is by trying new things, and that inevitably means making mistakes. So it's always worth it to try things. It's always worth it to expand your potential, and you always have to remember there's no way you're ever going to be perfect at it.
And so is it better to try something and make a mistake than just never having tried it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, people always say, I regret the things I didn't do much more than the things I did. And I think that we all regret when we back away from something and feel we just didn't have the guts to go through with it, whatever it may be. Whether it's an emotional, whether it's asking a girl out or going for a job or, you know, trying mountain climbing, whatever. I'm not saying you have to try all those things. I don't think you all have to constantly be challenging yourself. I don't like that idea that every day you have to do something special. I think life is hard. And I think there's times we just want to be comfortable. I say, we all feel really good when we climb that mountain and we get to the top and we're hot and sweaty and we've done it. And that's what challenging yourself is. And we need to do that in life. But we also need to know there's days we just want an amble in the park. And that's okay too. So I'm not saying you have to do this all the time, but I think most of us know when it counts and when it doesn't.
So to pick your battles.
Exactly.
And don't be afraid of losing.
That's exactly right. Don't be afraid of losing. You know, and don't idealize other people and think nobody else makes mistakes. We all do. Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody has done things they've screwed up at. And, you know, that is honestly life. And if we can any way really believe that, we've taken a big step forward.
And sometimes the greatest thing is when you have an expert that you follow and you think they're just the greatest. Again, whether it's an expert musician, a politician, whatever. And they screw up, and they come out, and they just lay it all out and say, I completely messed up here. Doesn't it just feel good? they screw up, and so that's great. But it's just that, you know what, there are no experts. And if they can screw up, I can screw up.
Absolutely. I think it's that feeling of relief we have shows how much we hold on to this idea that we shouldn't screw up. I mean, when Barack Obama was sworn in, and
yes.
Recall, they made a mistake. The Chief Justice made a mistake in the swearing in, and it was sort of funny. And I don't think anybody took it. I don't know. Maybe President Obama felt bad, or the Chief Justice. But it was. Most of us just thought it was kind of odd and a little funny. And yet, there's a. You know, I remember reading a letter to the editor talking about saying how that kind of made him feel good. He felt like if they can do that in that most important of events, it's okay when he does it.
Absolutely. I mean, just the Super Bowl, Christina Aguilera messed up the national anthem in front of, it was probably, 50 million people. And then I'm sitting there going, okay, if I screw up on a column, big deal. You know, how many people do I have reading my columns?
Well, that's exactly it. Or I have to say, having written about doctors and pilots, I'm probably not going to kill anybody with my mistakes.
Probably not.
Can I add one more thing to that,
Please,
Robert?
Please, I would love for you to.
Just what you said about people making mistakes, because this research, I think when we, back to the fixed and growth mindset, when we have a fixed mindset and other people make mistakes, we tend to want to, when we have a fixed mindset, and the research has shown this, if we're told, and we do poorly on something, and this has been an experiment that was done. If we have a fixed mindset and we do poorly on something, and we're told we can either look at people who did better or worse, those with a fixed mindset tend to look at people who did worse. Mm-hmm. Those with a growth mindset tend to look at people who did better because they want to learn. Those with a fixed mindset want to feel superior. And I think it's really important. I've certainly found myself thinking, well, at least I'm better than her or him. And that's okay. That's human nature. But I think if we really want to learn from mistakes, we have to, you know, when you talked about Christina Aguilar or Barack Obama, if the feeling is not, man, they really screwed up, but just like, okay, they screwed up. We all screw up. They're learning. She took a risk. My God, she's saying at the Super Bowl. For President Obama, can you imagine a bigger risk than running for President of the United States? And so I think that if we look at it not in a way to feel superior, but as a way to learn, that's a really important distinction.
That's a huge distinction. I mean, so the greater the risk, the greater the mistakes, and really the greater the chance for success.
Exactly.
You're upping the volume on everything, and it, you know, you're going to have huge mistakes. And if you do have huge mistakes, there's probably a better chance you're going to have much greater success.
And one more takeaway, I'm never going to let you go. One more takeaway is one mistake doesn't ruin everything. I used to make a mistake in a article or column, and to me, that was it. It was a disaster. That was done. Now I can realize even if there's one small factual error, the rest of the column probably offers some pretty good advice to people, and they're still getting a lot out of it.
And there's a common sort of saying that is, if you're not making a mistake or if you're not screwing up every day, you're probably not taking enough risk.
Exactly. And just because you make one error, it doesn't ruin everything else. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. Or we tend to internalize it in a way that I'm a failure, I'm a loser. No, we have to say, I made a mistake. That's a huge difference.
And I think maybe we put way too much emphasis on our ability to we think too highly of ourselves, because if you're a pilot and you screw up, that's disastrous. If you're a writer and you screw up, you think, oh, gosh, the world's going to end. It's terrible.
Yeah.
No, not really.
No one really cares. Yeah. No, it's really not. and the thing is, we do the best because we want to do the best we can. It's not what the, you know, of course we care what people think, but we you're right. It's got to be. We can't sit there and think, oh, my God, I made such a fool of myself. That's not the takeaway.
Right. No. And I think most people are so focused on themselves that they don't even really recognize other people's mistakes.
I know that. I mean, the classic, my dad, I have two sisters, so my dad was the only man in a room, in a house full of girls, and we used to agonize what to wear to a party, what to wear to something. He'd say, do you think anyone's really looking at you? And he used to have this beard for about 20 years, and when he shaved it, when he was still working, he went to work. 20 years he had the beard. He went to work, and people said, "What? Well, something's changed about you. Did you get new glasses?" And he said, "See how little people really look at people."
Isn't that great? I mean, can you imagine how much more we would do if we just realized that? No one really is paying attention.
Exactly.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Alina. And for
You're
anyone
welcome.
Who, if you want to learn more from Alina, certainly get the book, Better by Mistake. You can go to her website. It's www.alinatugend.com. And so if you're ready to put what you've heard into action, go to richerlife.com to get the action script, the mind map, the video, the ebook from this interview. And we're also going to do some voicemail coaching as well. So if you want some additional tips from Alina, check it out. Sign up for it. You can also go to the message board for this interview and tell the community your takeaway from what you heard today. And I'm Robert Pagliarini, and we will see you next time.